Hello and welcome to a September 29 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Today's guest is Timothy Trapp, who is with us from Ohio. Is that not right, Timothy?
Yes, that's correct.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Mr. Trapp has many, many years, in fact, 42 years experience as an entrepreneur businessman. 28 of those years has worked as a scientist and engineer. He has numerous interests in the field of alternative energy. He's taught college-level physics and mathematics. Quite qualified to talk to us today about many, many different technologies that would help our world to eliminate the need for filthy fuel-type energy systems such as we've all been guilty of using throughout our lifetimes. So, Timothy, how about if we talk about your background, get people acquainted with where you come from and what you've been up to?
Sure. First, I would like to say it's a pleasure to be here, James, and I appreciate you inviting me. I appreciate everything you're doing. We need more people like you that are making the world know that are helping the world to know that there are alternatives out there.
Well, you know, sometimes those of us who are involved in alternative energy, we can assume that everyone knows what we know and knows of the people that we know. But the fact is that although I've known you now for about a year, we've never actually met, but we've been in communication for over a year, most people have never heard of you. In spite of your having been around the world and working with alternative energy, there are many people who have no idea who you are, so I felt that it was very appropriate that this show be dedicated to acquainting people with you and your work.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate it. Basically, a little bit about my background since you asked that. I've been interested in science and technology all my life, and I gave my heart to the Lord when I was 8 years old. I started serving the world and God to make this place a better place.
Now, let me stop you for just a second here, because this is somewhat of a contradiction in many people's minds. People tend to think that religion or a person being a God-fearing or a religious person means that they would not be interested in science and technology, and that's a big mistake.
Yeah, it's quite to the contrary. I've hired over in World Improvement Ministries and World Improvement Technologies, we've probably had over 300 or 400 people working for us over the years, maybe more. And I would say, without a doubt, all the best scientists are God-fearing. There's a few that are atheists and still not too bad as far as scientists go, but without a doubt, all the great scientists are God-fearing. Different ones down through history, you think about Einstein. There was probably a time in his life when he went a little bit atheist, but they always come back to God. He made a lot of comments about God. He didn't believe God played dice with the universe and so on and so forth.
Yeah, very interesting. And, you know, I know that's not the purpose of our program, but I do think it's worth mentioning or getting into this just a little bit. Why do you think it is that so many of the great scientists in the past, such as Lavoisier and Volta and Faraday and so on and so on, they were believers. They were very religious people.
Yes, and I do believe God gives insight to those who fear him and honor his name. The scripture says that he enjoys doing stuff like that. I'm trying to get the exact words. He hides these things from the wise and intelligent, but reveals them to babes.
So you're implying that not only does God reveal spiritual truths to his people, but he even reveals truths about science and the universe.
Yeah, I think all truth really has a spiritual nature, in my opinion. All truth and all important things that have to do with life and health and godliness all have a spiritual nature about them. Jesus, when he healed people, occasionally he would tell the Pharisees that this too is a spiritual work, doing good toward others and helping the poor and helping the needy and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, it does seem that the faith that is required to believe in God and to actually dedicate one's life to serving him is somehow, it makes it easier for the person, and I'm not talking about gullibility, but it does make it easier for a person to accept some of the facets of alternative energy discoveries that, in other words, a person who is an atheist, which I have been, I was actually raised an atheist, more or less, perhaps the skepticism that is typical of an atheistic or secular viewpoint makes it harder for a person to accept that there's such a thing as over-unity energy production.
Yeah, you're right. And there's a certain, in order to get any progress, I believe you have to be willing to consider that you may be wrong on some of your basic ideas in order to make the next step. And advanced energy is one of those. For a long time, when I went to school and when I went to college, they taught that any extra energy system was impossible. And yet, if you keep open mind and you look around us, you see lightning storms that have quite a bit of extra energy there, enough to toast you and roast you and about a billion times over. And there's thousands of these storms going on all throughout. I think there's 200 and some lightning storms going on all the time on the planet. And any one of those is capable of supplying all the energy needs of the whole planet. And so people have overlooked this, and we've been taught that it's impossible, yet it's going on not just on this planet, but also on the sun. There's a huge amount of energy, and there's storms that go on, and so on and so forth. So there's quite an abundance, but it's easy to get your mind to fit into a mold. We actually go through some degree of brainwashing when we go to regular schools. At least we used to. Nowadays, they're opening up to this stuff. I know people that teach at MIT and many of the good colleges around the world, and they are teaching their students about over-unity now and so on.
Well, even perpetual motion, couldn't we just point to an atom and say that the notion that there is such a thing as perpetual motion should be obvious because it's all around us.
Absolutely. Even the Earth. The Earth is in perpetual motion. It moves around the sun and it rotates on its axis. And, the moon revolves around the Earth and so on and so forth. It's obvious when we decide to have an open mind. It's easy to think closed-minded, at least it used to be, because we were taught that so much.
Okay, so let's get back to your background then. You were born and raised in Ohio, is that correct or no?
I was born in Alaska and raised there. I was on my own pretty much as a child. Worked full-time starting at 5 years old. I went to school about 3 days a week for 6 hours a day, and then the rest of the time I worked. And
now, what does a five-year-old do in a full-time job?
I was cutting wood in the wintertime, which is firewood, basically.
That's not easy work.
Operating a chainsaw and operating an axe. And actually, the first few years, we didn't even have a chainsaw. Everything was done with an axe. The first 3 years of from the time I was five until I was eight. In the summertime, people don't need firewood, so I have commercial fish, which basically you get on the boats and you go out and check the nets, and you reset the nets, and you clean the nets, and you mend the nets, and basically a lot to do with catching fish and nets.
Did you begin this work at age five?
Age five, full time. I was actually part time at age three. So
wasn't slave labor or anything. This is something you did voluntarily.
Well, it's pretty close to it. In those days, if there were any labor laws, I didn't know anything about them. Nobody told me. A lot of people I know. There were other people, young people that were working, probably not as young as I was when I was five, but there were others that were working full time also. So it was a common way of life in the remote areas of Alaska. And up until the 70s, early 70s, when it gradually died out.
Isn't that something? Now, at some point you left Alaska and took up residence in Florida, is that correct?
That's correct. When I was 15, I moved to Florida, and I started building. I was looking for somewhere warmer, and of course Florida's quite a bit warmer. And
the extreme of the country, huh?
I started building the houses and doing construction. Well, actually, I was doing construction before then, but that's when I became a general contractor at age 15. And my goal was to build 17 houses before I turned 17, and I did that. And I was real pleased with myself. But, the whole thing really is serving the Lord, and he's really the one that made things work out, and he's one that gives blessings and so on. We put him first. I wasn't trying to succeed in a great way at anything other than serving God. The whole goal, I believe, for all of us is when we stand before the throne on Judgment Day is that he can look down and say, well done, good and faithful slave.
Well, that's what Solomon said. He said that is the whole obligation of man, to fear the true God and serve his commandments. And if people did that, then most of the world's problems would basically disappear.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. We need more people get involved in these type of things, in these type of endeavors. That's why I appreciate your show. It helps inspire that type of thinking and type of doing. So that's all very good.
Okay, now, and going back to your early life, at what point did you become interested in alternative energy?
Well, I was interested even when I was six. I occasionally had ideas that would pop into my head. And
what kind of idea pops into the head of a six-year-old about alternative energy?
Well, in my when I had some spare time when I was six, I would go out and I'd build different rope swings. And I enjoyed, you know, using playing on the swings if I ever had time, which occasionally, maybe one day a week if I was lucky, I'd get a day off. And it was an interesting lesson in the laws of physics when you play on a rope swing. You jump off a high place and you swing. And at first you weigh absolutely nothing, and then all of a sudden you're at the bottom of the swing, and you probably weigh three times your normal weight, depending on how high you jumped off. And that makes you think about things. One of the things that popped in my mind was a gravity motor in those days, a motor that would turn on gravity using these differential forces that I just described. So I immediately asked my teacher, my science teacher, about it. Actually, I didn't immediately. I think I waited about 6 months or so after I started thinking about it, And the science teacher, lady teacher, she said, "No, that's impossible. Anything like that's impossible. You might as well forget about it." So I did my best to forget about it, but it kept coming back to me. Those type of things kept coming back to me. I started building different tests and experiments, even as young as 8 years old, to see if any of these things would look like they're going to work.
Amazing. Well, I dare say the average 8-year-old isn't thinking about such things now.
Yeah, there's a few. I actually had a kid, we have different volunteers, our whole organization is volunteer, and we're World Improvement Ministries, and we actually had a kid that came by and volunteered. It was about 10 years old, and he was better than a lot of the PhDs that I had working for us back then. This is in Alaska, probably 12, 14 years ago, and he had already thought about a lot of this stuff when he came. And he had an interesting time building things. He was quite good, and natural with electricity.
Well, yeah, it would be nice if more emphasis were put in the school classrooms on this kind of thought process, innovation, you know.
Yes, and just as a side note there along those lines, we do volunteer in schools. I've given probably 200 or 300 different demos in schools over the years. So once a month or once, even twice a month, sometimes I'll go to a school, and if they invite me, and I'll give a demonstration on, usually on energy.
Yeah, that really is enjoyable, isn't it?
Yes,
I had a chance to do a little bit of teaching of school children in, associated with the museum, and that is really the most receptive audience and the most appreciative, really.
Yeah, if you think about it, when you and I went to school, the most interesting days is when someone would come and talk to us about their job and about their work and about their ideas. And of course, science has always been fascinating for me, and I don't think I ever remember the whole time I went to school anybody coming in and giving a demonstration in science. But it's good that people do that, because then the children get to see what it's all about hands-on and not just in books and in pictures.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when you're able to show them some technology that will have a real impact on their world.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to think about how afraid children must be when they hear all about, you know, icebergs melting, and the forecast for this world is not very good from the scientific community. And they're not really offering any answers. They're talking about what harm is being done by carbon pollution and so on, but they don't really have any answers like you and I are promoting.
Right.
So
well,
for us to go to a school is a totally different situation than for some physicists from academia to show up there.
Right. There are, like I say, there are things beginning to happen in the higher levels of schooling, colleges, I'll say. Around the world, there have been a number of colleges that have verified different over-unity experiments that we've been promoting for close to 20 years. And I'll give a specific here. One of the demonstrations is on the transmitting of electrical energy. It can be done and can be received in excess of what you sent out from the transmitter.
Really? Now, you're talking about Tesla-like transmission.
Yes, Tesla was one of the early pioneers in this field. Another one before Tesla was Stubblefield, Nathan Stubblefield.
I don't think very many people have heard of someone before Tesla named Stubblefield. Can you elaborate on his history?
He was from Pennsylvania, and there was also Keeley. Keeley was before Tesla, John Worrall Keeley. A lot of people have heard of him. Stubblefield, there was actually a museum regarding Stubblefield, or at least talk of a museum regarding Stubblefield's work. And I believe, again, he's in your neck of the woods, Kentucky, Tennessee, I said Pennsylvania. That was Keeley, so I should correct myself there. Keeley was in Pennsylvania. Stubblefield was Kentucky, I believe, or Tennessee, if I'm remembering.
Well, you know, to be perfectly honest, I'd never heard of him before you mentioned him just before this program.
Yeah, if you go online and type in Nathan Stubblefield, you'll find different technologies. He actually patented the Earth battery, a number of different versions and varieties of that. He was one of the few people in those days that actually ran his house on free energy. He heated his house and lighted his house on free energy. Way back 1880s, he was doing this in the 1880s, but he passed away about 1920 or somewhere in there, if I remember right, 1911, somewhere in that range. And when he passed away, it's an interesting story. The neighbors all thought he was still alive because they'd go to his house and there'd be no frost on the windows. It was wintertime. There's no frost on the windows. And so obviously somebody's in there keeping the fire burning. And this went on a couple months, and then people said, well, we better check on him, and they broke in the door, and they found that the house was heated, but it wasn't heated with fire. It was heated with two parabolic mirrors facing each other with a dominant energy system running, and he was dead in bed. He'd been dead for two or three months.
Wow.
And the house was still heated and lighted. And,
what an interesting story. Where does one find this story at? Is this in a newspaper, or...?
Well, you might be able to find some articles somewhere. You do some research on it. You know, we've been in this field for in excess of 25 years now. Actually, I think about 27. And we've had hundreds of people work for us over the years and work with us, volunteers and so on. Like I say, all of us are volunteers. But these stories wind up getting handed down. And there's a merit of truth. If you hear it from five different people, the same story or similar versions of the story. And there was a guy that, like I say, he either was hoping to put together a Stubblefield Museum, or he did, and he was, wish I could remember his name. If it comes to me, I'll let you know.
Well, the first thing I'm going to do as soon as this program is over is do some research on Stubblefield. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, his battery is a good device, too. All it was two, and it's just public domain now, so anybody can go on the patent and look it up, but I'll describe it if you'd like.
Sure.
Would you like me to describe the battery?
Please.
I'm sorry. Should I go ahead? Okay. Yeah, it's basically you take a strand of about number six copper, maybe 30 feet long, and a strand of same diameter iron wire, and you can get soft iron wire in that diameter, and you insulate both of them. You can use, you want something that's porous, so you can use like the tape they use at the hospital. Just wrap it around the wire all the way down. And you'd wind these two wires on a big bolt, like a 1-inch diameter bolt.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get that all done, you bury that in the ground and leave two ends of one end of each wire sticking up. And those two, you can be hooked to a circuit. It's basically an Earth battery. You get about 1.5 volts at maybe 5 or 10 amps.
That high amps?
Yeah. If you do it right, if you use the right kind of wire, it's you may not get that much the first try because the good wire is hard to get. But there are available sources. But yeah, you can get maybe 4 or 5 amps at 1.5 volts. Now, if you just do that, your battery will decay like any other battery, and in a few years you won't get hardly anything. You'll still get the 1.5 volts. But if you know how to tune it to the dominant, which is what Stubblefield did, and how he learned, I don't know. Maybe he just learned from lots of trial and error and asking the Lord for direction. But he did learn how to tune it to the dominant, and when you tune any battery to the dominant, it winds up not decaying in the normal way. The things that you run into on this type of battery, virtually none. There's no danger unless you got a huge arc that would burn through the tape, and then you might have a problem. But otherwise, That battery lasts for 100 years easy.
And so in order to produce usable power, you would install a number of these and hook them in series, is that it?
Yeah, that's one of the ways. Build a number of them, hook them in series, and you can have 12 volts. You can say you hook about 9 of them in series or so, and you'd have about 12 volts and usable power, in other words, and usable amps. Like I say, though, if you really want it to last, otherwise you'll either be looking at decay in about a year, or you have to learn how to tune to the dominant. But once you do that, what Stubblefield did is he put a secondary winding over these first two windings, or you could call it a tertiary winding if you want to, over these first two windings. And the other winding was just regular copper wire, which you could use enameled wire, which is easily available now. And he would put about 2,000 or 3,000 turns on that one. And so what that caused, and he buried all that in the ground with the two ends of the high inductance coil sticking up, what that caused is a high voltage arc that would come off of that multi-wire, the ones with a few thousand turns, that tertiary inductor, would produce thousands of volts. And that, once you have high voltage, you don't need amperage to make power. You can make amperage. So you would have the high voltage and also the high frequency just from that tertiary coil.
And he was doing this in the late 19th century, early 20th century.
Yeah, see, he was doing demonstrations of these type of devices, including what we call nowadays a telephone. And these type of devices were developed in the 1870s by Stubblefield. Keeley was also in Pennsylvania. He was doing similar work about the same time. Maybe,
but not with electricity.
Oh, Keeley definitely worked with electricity.
Did he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of people don't understand because they see spheres and so on and so forth. If you look at our videos, you'll see spheres and so on and so forth. But it's all electricity in that it's energy that travels through wires. And if you pull it apart while it's conducting, usually you get an arc. If you define electricity in those terms, if you define electricity strictly as electron flow, then these guys knew how to do electron flow, and they were working with it, but that's not their primary energy. When you tap the dominant or radiant energy, it's not electron flow in the ordinary sense by any means. There's many types of subatomic particles.
Now, do you find any evidence of communication between these three greats who were all in the eastern U.S.?
There's evidence that Tesla knew about Stubblefield. He didn't mention him by name, but he mentioned people doing work with Earth batteries and the Earth batteries lasting way longer than they should. And he said, this is not ordinary electricity. These people are doing something more advanced. So he would have been referring to Stubblefield. And then there's probably others besides Stubblefield in those days that was doing that. That was Tesla's writing where he referred to that. And then Keeley and Tesla, in their writings, both referred to each other in a similar manner without mentioning names.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but mentioning the work they were credited with. I forget the exact quotes. I'd have to think about it for a little bit.
Very interesting. Let me ask you one more thing before we move on from Stubblefield. Could you elaborate on the two parabolic mirrors that created heat in the home?
Yeah, if you got a high voltage, high frequency source, and you know how to tune that, there's a lot of adjustments, minute adjustments necessary to get it to produce what we call the dominant flow. It's actually a balanced polar, dipolar, and parapolar, three types of dominant electricity balanced. When you get them all flowing properly in your system, and this is what Stubblefield knew how to do, then you can take highly polished mirrors, two of them. You can use, we've used stainless steel cooking bowls. They're not quite perfect, but they're close. And of course, they're polished nowadays. In those days, they had to come up with something themselves besides the stainless steel. It wasn't available in the 1800s. But we've used the stainless steel, I guess they're called salad bowls. I said cooking bowls.
Uh-huh.
Bowls. And we've also used hemispheres where you can order hemispheres in different materials. You can make them if you know how. They're it's a process. a lathe that you can make a hemisphere. But anyway, if you take a hemisphere or a soupy salad bowl, so you face them toward each other, you have the right kind of energy on each of them, you have the right distance apart, they'll start radiating heat. They both get so hot you can't touch them. And if you do touch them, you get an arc onto your finger. It doesn't hurt a great deal, but they are quite hot. And
separated by what distance?
The distance is critical, but it has to do with how much energy is flowing in the system, so it depends on the energy. You'll notice, if you experiment with the distance, you'll notice there's an ideal distance where you get maximum radiated energy. You know, one way to do this nowadays is with what's called a tri-field broadband meter. You can buy those for a couple $100 and have them sitting, say, 6 or 8 feet away from your experiment. And when you move those plates further apart, you'll see that maybe it's an inch, or maybe it's 5 inches, or maybe it's 10 inches. Somewhere in there, you'll notice that that's the highest reading on the broad thick band meter. If you keep going further apart, it'll start to go back down again. And that point of that highest reading is basically you're getting a lot of energy transfer from one hemisphere to the other, or one plate to the other, if you want to say it that way. And that energy transfer isn't by any means ordinary electricity, but it is somewhat similar to transmitted electricity. And that will start literally heating the plates. And you can even do this with your hand in a circuit. Some people are sensitive enough with their hands, and I think in the old days they probably were. They probably didn't have tri-field broadband meters like we do today. But some people can actually have one plate there, and they can put their hand, and they can tell by moving their hand what they feel exactly where the best spot is for the second plate. And, you know, like I say, it depends on the voltage. It depends on how much amount of energy you got flowing through your circuit.
So are you making an electrical connection to both of the bowls then, or just to one of them?
Yeah, both of the bowls will have an electrical connection.
And are you going positive to one, negative to the other, or?
Well, we're dealing with AC here, so you wouldn't normally deal with positive and negative. Well, see, on your battery, once you put that tertiary coil on there with the high turns, and you start pulsing the primary, in other words, allow those two wires to touch and open, break and open, you're basically creating a pulse that goes into the secondary. The secondary winds up being AC.
Okay.
And you bury that whole mechanism in the ground, just have the wires come up. What Stubblefield did is he had the top of his sticking out, that one-inch bolt that went down through the center. He'd have the top of that sticking out, and he'd put a set of points on there with a little magnetic coil. And so basically the electromagnet would when the points came together, let's just say it this way, the points come together, the energy flows, and that causes the electromagnet to repel, which opens the points. But the points are on a spring, so they spring beyond where they're supposed to go, and then they wind up coming back together, and so then they touch again, and then they wind up repeating that cycle over and over and over, hundreds of times a second. And that's basically how you got his AC from those earth batteries.
Very interesting. So he connected the two parabolic mirrors to that earth battery. Is that the idea?
Yes. There's a number of different apparatus, capacitors, inductors, and resistors that need to go in there for tuning.
But he didn't have those. He couldn't have those.
Yeah, you can make your own capacitor and your own inductor and your own resistor is pretty easy. And he
but those
probably
things didn't exist when he did his, did they?
Well, if you make your own, they did. If you have a wire, which they had wire in those days, and you wind a wire up, that's an inductor. If you wind two wires up, and they're not actually physically connected, but they're physically real close to each other, but they're insulated from each other, that's a capacitor. And if you just take a piece of something that doesn't conduct too good, like iron or whatever, and that's a resistor, basically. So by varying the length and the diameter of your resistors and your inductors and so on and so forth, you can do all the tuning that we do with modern components. You can do it with just wire, basically.
That's very interesting. So you're saying that he basically had a pulsing AC current that was bouncing back and forth between these mirrors and creating enough heat to warm his house?
That's correct. It is dominant energy. In other words, if you just take that Earth battery and do the basic things I described, you'll have a battery that's that puts out a little bit of power. But as far as getting the dominant end, see, to make the high voltage, high frequency energy into amperage requires that you understand the basics of stage three, which is our radiant energy, which is way more complex than I can describe here on the radio. There's actually classes that are that we occasionally teach, and again, everything's by donation. But it's several months of learning to understand even the basics of dominant energy. But it's all doable. You can take high voltage, high frequency, and turn it into amperage if you know how.
Well, here's my question: what's the possibility of creating or marketing a home heating device such as you've described here?
We have been endeavoring to market different home heating devices. We have one that's a sphere, closer related to Keeley's work. It basically will heat a couple gallons of water up in a couple minutes with just a couple watts. It'll heat it from room temperature all the way up to boiling. And that
it heats water from the inside of the sphere? You put water in it and...
Water inside the sphere, and you can have your tubes to circulate the water. If you want to use it for a home heating device, you could either blow a fan directly across the sphere and heat the home that way, or you could run it through radiators or baseboard heating, what we call nowadays baseboard hot water heating. And that's all. There's many ways to do this, and this is a device that a technology that we'd like to implement. And so, we've been giving demonstrations on these type of things for about 20 years, basically.
So let's go on then. We in your own personal history, we were talking about how you were doing construction, building houses, and so on. At what point did you start working in the field of alternative energy?
When I was 23, I was really looking for what to do. Actually, 21, I should back up a little bit. I actually first funded alternative healing research and development. We had some incredible results in different machines that were built then. And
machines that would be akin to what that people might be familiar with?
The closest thing, if you could look up online, would be... I'm trying to think of the guy's name. Henry Morey did some work in this field. So did Tesla. But they're basically using electrical machines for healing.
Are you talking about something similar to Raymond Royal Rife?
Yes. It's along the same lines. The guy specifically that worked with us had previously worked in France in the 1960s and 1970s on a project there. The head guy, if somebody wanted to look up online, is Antoine Prey, maybe that's the way to pronounce it. The last name is spelled P-R-I-O-R-E. Antoine is the first name. And he was a scientist over there that developed a machine that basically would heal anything you need to heal, even regrowing limbs, regrowing teeth, regrowing eyes, that people had missing eyes, missing teeth, whatever. And that project was so successful that it was shut down. Well, it wasn't really shut down. It went in top secret. Officially, it was shut down, but it went top secret with the French government and the super rich bankers and all that. They basically took it all top secret, and officially it was shut down. Well, one of the guys that worked on that project came and worked for us not too long after that. Well, actually, it was 10 years or so after that project got shut down that he came and worked for us, 8 years, something like that, in the early 80s, 81, approximately, when he worked for us. And we duplicated that machine and had very good success with it as far as healing and health benefits.
Now, what was the basic principle or premise on which it worked?
Basically, if you energize the cells correctly, they will repair themselves. And basically, that's the basic premise. It's basically the, again, there's many types of energy. There's over 27 types of electrical energy that I know of, and I haven't learned everything about all of them, and I think there's more to learn. In other words, there might be 40 types of electrical energy that I don't know about yet. It's possible. So basically, your cells actually harmonize with certain types of electrical energy, or they can become energized with certain types of electrical energy. And these energies can exist in the form of fields, or they can exist in the form of flows. Almost all the different types, the 27 types that I know of, can either exist as a field or as a flow. And the fields will do certain things to your body, and the flows will do certain things to your body. And so basically, if you energize the cells, you wind up repairing the telomerase, which is the ends of the DNA strands and RNA strands and all those. That's what winds up making problems in your body as you get older. Your cells don't reproduce as well as they should. And usually you can relate it back to the telomerase. And so what we found is these cells would start healing and becoming more vibrant and reproducing much more perfect examples of what they should have been in the first place. And basically it resulted in, on the animal studies we did, it resulted in old animals basically looking and behaving just like young animals. We had one dog that was missing teeth and blind and had a leg amputated, and he wound up healing up almost 100% before the experiment was done, basically, including regrowing the leg.
You got to be kidding.
It's incredible.
Now, why hasn't this been given any publicity, or has it?
Well, see, the really good stuff, the government does. I don't know if we should go into all that. But there's definitely opposition on the really good stuff. So I'll put it that way.
Has there ever been any news programs or newspaper articles about a dog regrowing its leg?
Well, like I say, France, Ferrari, he got a little bit of publicity, and it was officially shut down, but it really just went into top secret levels.
Now, who would be against doing something like this? Say, for instance, all the soldiers coming back missing limbs and so on.
The problem that they have from the world control point of view, from the super rich that are controlling the world, is they think there's too many people already. And if you start healing up everybody, and it looks to me like your lifespan might wind up being 500 years or 800 years or something like this. And if you start healing up everybody and they start living for 500 or 800 years, you're going to have a huge population explosion.
So you think there's a conspiracy going in which the super rich want to keep the world population at a level that can be sustained by this planet?
Yeah, there's definitely population control going on. It's not a matter of conspiracy. It's a matter of the people in power, which are the super rich. Basically, they want to keep the population control going on. You can do your own research. Everybody can do their own research into it. But if you check into where AIDS came from, you'll see that it was man-made by the super rich. The World Health Organization is one of them that made that disease, and so on and so forth. A lot of the diseases, the cancer for one, is totally curable. I've had cancer three times. I got over it all three times. Totally curable. Anybody can do it. And yet they're indoctrinated to believe they got to do chemo and radiation and all this. And really, that's what kills them. That damages the body so many times that a large percentage, 20 or 30% of them wind up dying from the chemo and the radiation, in my opinion. Now, this is just my opinion. So hopefully I'm protected I'm allowed to speak my opinion here.
Oh, of course. It's very, very interesting. Of course, the purpose of this program is to discuss alternative energy as opposed to alternative health, but it's all seemingly related. A lot of the resonant type theory seems to apply equally to healing sick people as well as to produce free energy.
Yeah, so when we had, just like getting back to the subject, when we had such success with alternative healing, we had a number of negative things, which I'd rather not talk about. It goes into, they came along about then, and so we decided to switch into other things that would help the planet, which would be like pollution remediation. That was one of the early ones, and alternative energy were two of the things we started working on.
No, not to be delving back into it, but what you just said about running into problems, are you talking about opposition?
Yes.
Okay.
They're very powerful entities on the planet that want to keep things moving at the pace they've set. And for a long time, that meant no significant improvements in alternative energy. The good point is that about 2 years ago, this is 2007, about 2 years ago, about 2006, early part, somewhere in there, there was a massive die-off of honeybees and other pollinators. Have you heard about that?
Yes. That's being attributed to cell phone towers, isn't it?
Well, they try to blame anything, but they try to blame it on the people so that the people won't find out who's really the fault. But it's due to pollution, and a lot of that's due to fossil fuels is what it's, in my opinion, is. I'm allowed to stay safe, my opinion, I guess. So basically, when that happened, there was a certain percentage of the super rich that decided if we better look into this, and then they had the scientists report that if all the pollinators die off, or even 50, 60, 70, 80% of them die off, then we're looking at possible extinction of the human race, as well as all other mammals and so on and so forth, and a lot of plants. And so at that point, they decided, well, we better flip these alternative energy systems come out. And so now there's a move. In the last year or 2 years, there's been a major move to get alternative wind and alternative solar and, you know, these types of alternatives out into the main part of the marketplace. And no longer is there the persecution that there was for the first 22 years I was in this field.
So you feel like there has been a change in the reducing of the opposition to...
Absolutely. Now the bankers for the first time are financing these things, whereas before they did everything they could to eliminate you.
Can you point to an example of someone who's receiving financing or some product that's already coming out on the market that is an evidence of what you're saying?
Let me think for a second. Market product. Okay, let's take the solar panels for example. 5 years ago, if you bought a solar panel and you shade it with a single cloud over the sun, just a thin, wispy little cloud over the sun, you get 0 watts off your panel, and even that would be a 100-watt panel. Nowadays, you buy a solar panel in this climate, it can be dark, it can be cloudy and ready to storm, thoroughly cloudy, and you still might get 5 or 10 watts off of that 100-watt panel. But that shows a significant improvement, and if you check those companies that make those panels, you'll see that they've been sinking a lot of money. And most of it goes back to Exxon and the big oil companies, the super rich. You'll see that they've been sinking a lot of money and getting government grants at the same time to develop these panels to become better systems. So basically, they are making improvements in that direction in both wind and solar and water generation. Those, the typical three. The big three, if you want to call
yeah.
it that.
Speaking of water, why don't we use the remaining, we have about 13 minutes remaining. Why don't we talk about water cars, since that is the thrust of this, the museum and this program. You have had quite a bit of experience with using water as fuel.
Yes.
When did your interest in that begin?
Probably about 1992, so that's been about 15 years ago.
Now, were you living in Ohio at the time?
No, I lived in Alaska most of my life, up until probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay, so you were in Alaska, and what got you thinking about water as fuel?
Well, we were doing research and development on everything. We had over 50 guys working full-time, and, well, some of them women, I say guys, some of them women, and everybody, again, almost everybody was volunteering, but we were building testing three machines a day. In other words, there might be 20 machines in the works at all times, 20 or 30. And one of the guys decided, said, hey, I've heard of people laying cars on water. Let's see if it's doable. And so we started doing the research, which is the first part of any machine, to see what's been done and if there's any useful information out there. And at that point, we'd already known about radiant energy, and we had seen a number of things. I'll give you one example that I'd seen. I was working on what we call a delay line motor, which is an over-unity motor. And I remember somebody handed me a cold drink, and a little drop of water came off the outside of the drink. I think it was a soda pop or something, but a little drop of water came off and landed on the commutator, and instantly a puff of steam came off the commutator, instantly. And yet I know that there was less than maybe 1 milliamp flowing through that commutator. So normally you wouldn't get steam instantly with 1 milliamp. And so that was one of the things I had seen previously, maybe 5 years earlier, and it kind of stuck in my mind. And so, when they suggested running cars on water, I immediately figured it was totally doable. And so we started working on it. Within 6 months, we had an engine running on water.
And what type of electrolyzer or whatever were you using?
On the first one, it was a large electrolyzer with multiple plates. It had approximately 60 plates, and it was about 100 volts DC input into that, and pulsating DC, I should add, with an RF envelope on top of the DC. And the RF was not in the regular energy range. It was in what we call dominant energy fields. And so there were fields and flows stationary in the machine, stationary fields and flows moving, dominant energy. And basically that's what you need to electrolyze water, in my opinion. Now, there's probably other ways to do it that I'm not familiar with, but that's one of them.
Okay. And this is along the lines of a Bob Boyce type?
Yeah, I would say the closest to what people talk about nowadays would be Bob's device. Okay. Him and I have talked a number of times, and he's versed on he understands about the different types of energy fields and so on and so forth. And he even mentions in his literature now the need for getting the flows right and the fields right and so on.
So in other words, the most recent commentary on his type of device is that you are tapping into radiant energy, or?
Yes. Radiant energy is abundant in nature. Some people call it the ether field. It's quite abundant. It's everywhere, as far as we know. And it can be harnessed into electrical-like energy. Initially, it's not. Initially, it's sort of a field, sort of like invisible clouds. Wilhelm Reich wrote about argon, and that's basically what the dominant energy is in its natural state here on this planet. It's like clouds, three different kinds of clouds, which can mix in different ways. And Reich called it argon energy, and he said there's three different kinds. The difference would be he thought that two of the kinds were always bad and one of the kinds was always good. And the difference would be that we've proven in our work that all three kinds can be quite beneficial if they're in the right place at the right time. And all three kinds can be polluted or non-beneficial if they get mixed with the wrong kinds of energies or if they're in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Now, do you attempt to do any kind of harmonizing of this theory of argon energy with your understanding of the scriptures?
All things fit together. I'm not sure the scriptures really talk about argon energy.
That's what I was wondering. Are you because I understand certain people's reference to this. It almost sounds more religious in their description of it than scientific.
Well, people that don't understand things, they always try to put it in a religious context. I mean, not always, but generally. And so it's a common thing people do. Yeah, but the Ark of the Covenant was considered by some to be an argon accumulator, which I don't... You know, I mean, I believe it could have accumulated argon, but that's not by any means. The presence of God is a lot more powerful than any argon accumulator. So, my opinion is that the Ark of the Covenant was the presence of God up until Jesus died, and then the curtain was ripped in two from the top to the bottom, and the presence of God now dwells in people's hearts and their spirits, if you want to say it that way. Whereas previously, it dwelt, God dwelt both the ark or in the ark, or both, however you want to say it. But
so in other words, you're saying that you think it's a mistaken notion for people to try to explain, for instance, biblical miracles and so on, and in the spirit realm in general, and trying to sort of mix these two, the orgon with the spirit realm.
Well, it's, you know, everything lines up and everything fits together, but I would say that there's another level there that people are not aware of. People, because they don't know much about God and they don't know much about orgon, they want to put it all together.
And they tend to lump together, yeah.
Yeah, and just because you don't know much about some, there's not a reason to lump it all together.
Yeah, I wouldn't ask another guest this, but because I know that you've been involved in a ministry work for many, many years, and you've also been involved in alternative energy and these more, what would you call, non-conventional aspects of alternative energy, I thought it would be appropriate to ask you, of any of my guests, what your feeling is on this kind of confusion.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate the opportunity to give my viewpoint on it. And as always, it's a pleasure to visit with you, and an honor to be here.
Yeah, well, maybe we can continue to talk about one person who has been a great mystery for people all over the world who'd like to know more about him. That's Daniel Dingle. I understand that you've traveled to the Philippines on a number of occasions, and you have had the acquaintance of Mr. Dingle. You're familiar with his work.
Yes, I am. He is a fine man, a hard worker. He's got a kind of a large ego, but we love him anyway. And I'm sure I've been said the same thing about me.
So in other words, I think you're trying to help people appreciate that it isn't always easy to get information out of Mr. Dingle.
He has his own characteristics and his own habits and so on and so forth.
But he is an engineer, right? He worked as an engineer during his life.
He started at a very young age working full-time, and he's developed a huge number of useful inventions and technologies, and one of them is the water-powered car. He demonstrated that in the United States. He had an oil company back him. I think it was in the 70s or 80s.
He actually demoed his water car in the U.S.
And he had an oil company back him, and he got, like, the last page. And this is to show you how the newspapers are. He got the last page on the newspaper, but he did show me the clipping, and it was something like New York Times or something. You know, it was a major newspaper in the United States.
So there is some documentation of his having been in the U.S.
And not only was he in the U.S., but he drove that car from a very long distance, basically across the United States. I think from Michigan to either to Florida or to maybe it was out west like California, but a long distance, 2,000 miles or so. And they carefully monitored, it said right in the newspaper article, carefully monitored fuel consumption, and he only used like 5 gallons of diesel. It was some piddly little amount to drive a car 2,000 miles, and the rest was water, basically.
Oh, so he was actually boosting. Petroleum.
His system uses, in my expert opinion, and I hope he doesn't mind, I give away a few little things about his system. I don't think he does. Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. But his system actually uses diesel to start. They call it petrol over there to start the engine.
Now, this is a gasoline engine, a Toyota, right? Are we talking about the same car?
If it's the one, yeah, I think it's a Toyota.
The Toyota Corolla, the red one?
Yeah, I think it's a red Toyota Corolla, the one. He has had a couple different cars over the years, and I've seen more than one car, so I want to try to keep it as straight as I can.
Well, I'm referring to the one that's viewable online in a video that was made about 10 years ago.
Well, I haven't had a chance to look at that video, so I can't tell you, but I probably have seen that car.
Are you saying that he uses diesel fuel in a gasoline car?
He uses, I believe it's diesel. I could be wrong, but I'm fairly certain it's diesel to start it up. And once the engine's warm, even as soon as it starts, he can start adding water, which, again, this is electrolyzed water, so you could call it hydroxy or brown gas or whatever you want to call it. It's water in its gaseous state, and he starts adding that to the burn. And that, as long as you don't add too much, the engine will go ahead and perform normally. And once it gets up to operating temperature, he switches to 100%, or at least he claims, and it looks like he actually does, switch to 100% water at that point. And so, yeah, his technology is good and for real. And
in other words, the car does perform as well or better than it would on the regular fossil fuel using water, but it can't work in a cold state. Is that what you're saying?
It can work in a cold state, but his doesn't. His car does not work in a cold state. We built some that do, but his is built, and I'm sure he's built some that do too. It's a lot more complicated to get it to work in a cold state. Basically.
Now, are you implying that you've replicated his technology in addition to the earlier Bob Boyce style thing?
We did not replicate his technology, but we worked on a number of technologies that are similar.
And had them working, running vehicles.
Yes, working, running vehicles. As a matter of fact, his technology is not that much different from Bob Boyce's. Both of them use radiant energy. What Daniel's doing over there, Daniel Dingle, is a form of radiant energy.
Is he using
many
the superimposed waveforms in addition to DC? Is that the idea, similar to Bob's, or...?
Yeah, there's similarities to that. Basically, when I say radiant energy, I'm talking about using the other 26 different kinds of electricity besides electron flow, and you have to establish field and establish flow. So once you do that, that's what we categorize as radiant energy. And there's many ways to do it. In other words, you can use just any three of those, any three of the dominant energies, and like I said, there's about 26 of them, any three of the dominant energies and establish fields and establish flows, and you can do it. And so therefore, you can use a large number of different components. In some cases, you might use a toroid. In other cases, you might use a capacitor. So there's a large number. In other cases, you might use a resistor. And I don't want to make people misunderstand me. It's, when I say capacitor, inductor, resistor, it's you need a host of other devices. But those might be the window or the antenna or the receiver for the receiving or the beginning of getting dominant energy into your system, basically.
Very interesting. Well, we've come to the end of our hour, and I'm looking forward to us having another program together because there's a lot more to discuss. I thank you for being our guest today, and I'm going to post the information for people to contact you on the web page.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure. And, again, I really appreciate what you're doing, and I want to encourage all the listeners to listen in. And it's a good work that you're doing. These kind of things need to be supported.
Well, Timothy, thank you for joining us, and we'll look forward to doing another show in the near future.
Okay, sounds good.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.